This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today is Giving Tuesday, when we are encouraged to stop all the shopping and instead donate to worthy causes. Often that money goes to philanthropic foundations or corporate giving programs. And we hope that our contributions will make life better for those less fortunate. But does it? Edgar Villanueva spent a number of years working with nonprofit foundations, and he says his inside look showed him that these institutions may actually be doing more harm than good. He says their structure often reinforces racism and colonialism. He lays out the argument and some solutions in his new book, Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. Edgar Villanueva joins me now. Hello.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you with us. What do you mean now when you talk about the structures, the way in which philanthropies are structured reinforces these kinds of these old structures, colonialism, racism? How so?
Well, we have a tax system in the United States that actually allows for people with wealth and corporations with wealth to establish foundations. And more wealthy folks are seeing these opportunities to put their money into foundations versus, putting that money into the public system through taxation. We now have more than 100,000 foundations in the United States, and a large percentage of those were created in the past decade. And so more and more wealth is being put into the coffers of foundations versus put into the public system for safety net provisions.
Yeah, but the whole point of that is to encourage those people with wealth to put the money in those foundations, which then turn around and address some of the needs that we would also possibly address with our public spending system.
That's true, and I support that notion. I do think we need to take a step back to examine the big picture of what's happening in this country with the wealth gap. You know, how is it that folks are able to amass so much wealth in this country in the first place? But if they do, I support the notion of being able to, have foundations. Philanthropy has always played a role in supporting progress in this country, from the civil rights movement to, scientific breakthroughs. So there's definitely a place and a lot of good that's happening. But in the book, I point out opportunities for us to do better as a sector.
Well, you also point out that by law, only 5% of the money that foundations take in actually has to be doled out for those good causes for which we think our money is going. And therein lies a problem, because the rest of it goes into the system of finance. It goes into our banking system, which goes to other places to, in many cases, corrupt local values and extract wealth from those communities. So if 95% is going into a banking system that extracts wealth from people, and only 5% goes back to help out some of the problems that have been created by that, that's a bad ratio.
It is, Foundations have very little accountability in terms of how they're using their money, how they're investing their assets, and then very little accountability in terms of the money that's leaving the doors of the foundation being invested in community. And you're right, there was in the Tax Reform Act of 1969, this was legislation that put a minimum on foundations to pay out money into the community, because at that time, foundations were being established and getting a tax write-off for those dollars, but there was no public benefit to those dollars. And so this, what we call out the call a payout requirement enacted by Congress, was intended to be a minimum, and it has become, unfortunately, the default that most foundations only pay out about 5% of their assets into community benefit.
And this can get a little bit confusing, and we don't want to get into the numbers too much, but often you'll see foundations say, our overhead is only 25% or 20-25% or something like that, which is to say the operating costs, are only 25%. But that doesn't mean that 75% then goes to the causes that you say, because a lot of it stays invested, and they would say, well, to maintain that foundation, we have to keep a lot of it invested. And so what you're saying is, in most cases, only 5% gets paid out. Is that right?
That's correct. Only 5% is required by law to be used for charitable purposes. And so that is, you know, very problematic when you think about the $800 billion that are sitting in the bank that foundations have in their coffers. We really have there's a really big missed opportunity for that money to, you know, support our communities.
But you're saying even more than that in your book, Decolonizing Wealth. You talk more about, rather than just spend more of that money, it's the way in which the decisions are made, the boards are structured, that in itself is reinforcing some of the problems that nominally these foundations are trying to address. Tell us more about that.
That's true. So bottom line, when you look at the money that is being invested in communities, so the 5% of foundation assets at private foundations that is actually leaving the door, only a small percentage of that funding is supporting communities of color. In fact, in recent data, we saw only 7 to 8% of foundation dollars are being invested in communities of color. And so I think when you look at where we have the greatest needs in our communities around health disparities, the education gap, when we're looking at the race wealth gap and who has resources and who doesn't have resources, by far we see the need is greater in communities of color. However, communities of color are not benefiting from philanthropic investment. And so that is one of the injustices that I call attention to in the book.
Where is the money going and why does it get there and not to, as you would point out, the places of the greatest need?
Well, when you think about who has wealth in this country, so who in the first place has the ability to even start a foundation, more often than not, we're thinking about wealthy white families who have had intergenerational wealth transferred and passed down the line. So wealthy white folks are like many of us who, when it comes to giving, we give to organizations that we know, that we're acquainted with, we're supporting our friends and family. And so that's what you see happening at a larger scale with large foundations. The governance and the board of these organizations are often family members or folks that are in the network and known by the folks who start those foundations. The staff also reflects that demographic. And then so therefore the funding is going to large universities, large nonprofit organization, arts and different types of organizations that you know, may be of interest and known by those families. So therefore, small organizations working around the country in communities of color that may not be in that network or on the radar of those folks are often overlooked and marginalized by philanthropy.
You are an enrolled member of the Lumbee Tribe in North Carolina, and you worked at the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust. And there you got an insight into how some of this worked. And tell us more, because when you tried to raise some of these objections, observations, they weren't always greeted sympathetically.
That's true. So there is a certain culture that exists within philanthropic institutions that is a, you know, what felt like for me as a Native person coming from a poor community. My tribe is in Robeson County, where there's a lot of poverty. You know, getting on the inside of this institution, I felt that there was sort of a forced assimilation. And, you know, I compare it to if you imagine being from a poor family, being a person of color, and all of a sudden you are married into a family, a royal family perhaps, right? So how might you feel as an outsider in that space? And what might the expectations be for you to assimilate to that dominant culture that is in many ways not about the community and not about centering solutions from the community or people of color or, you know, the place where you came from, but more about, you know, lifting up the legacy of the family, focused on the foundation's reputation and the preservation and the growth of the wealth that is in the bank.
Talk about your experience when you made the suggestion, for instance, that, you know, on the table was the suggestion that a certain amount of money go to a hospital, and hospitals are certainly worthy foundations, worthy causes, but you wanted to get at some of the root causes for health and health disparities and thought maybe we better go look in the community and find out what the needs are and not give it to a hospital, which is frankly already funded and perhaps may already have the capacity to raise the money. Talk about that conversation.
Sure. So at the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust, we had a new president and she actually hired me. And together we were thinking through strategies that would get at the root causes of improving health in North Carolina, which is the mission of the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust. So that meant we had to look at who we were currently investing and who also was currently the most sick. When you look at the data, obviously in eastern North Carolina, some parts of western North Carolina, you have counties that have the highest rates of diabetes, high rates of mental illness. What are the strategies to reach those folks? It's when you think about hospitals, that's where you go when you're already sick. And so you have to go upstream to think about preventative opportunities that are often community-based outside of a hospital system to reach those folks. And many of those strategies are often led by folks from those communities who may be a part of a nonprofit that does not have a huge budget, that is not well-known, doesn't have a fancy website. And so they're often overlooked by philanthropy. When we begin to make changes at the foundation to want to fund those types of organizations, not cutting necessarily all hospitals out, but we wanted to just make a shift to be more inclusive, to make sure that we had folks from communities of color, folks from some of the tier one low wealth counties in North Carolina represented in our portfolios, there was some resistance because for many, many years, the foundation is now over 100 years old. Many of the institutions and the academic medical centers in North Carolina have been receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars from the foundation. So bringing on new folks for them meant less resources possibly for, you know, others.
What is the solution? You talk about a number of them. Representation or kind of more broader representation on those boards is one of the primary. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. So I believe there's a direct correlation between who is working in a foundation, who is on the board and has governance and decision-making power in these organizations with where money is being invested. And so when you bring folks into a foundation that have lived experience, that reflect the communities that you care about in your mission, you're going to see that those, you know, that set of relationships are going to accompany those people, and new types of opportunities and new solutions are going to be brought to the table. And so, you know, right now in philanthropy, about 85 to 90% of foundation boards are comprised of white folks and mostly white men. And so that's definitely one opportunity to diversify and to be more inclusive by having folks sitting in decision-making seats that actually come from the community and have that lived experience.
And interestingly enough, you talk about this too in the book, because we think, well, okay, but the money comes, it's a private foundation. It comes from families with money. That's how they got this big. And therefore they're private. But as you point out, there is a public connection because of the tax exemption. And so there is some way in which we could make this public policy, right?
I agree with that. I actually referred to money in foundations as being twice stolen. Once, when you think about the legacy of wealth and our history as it connects to colonization in this country, colonization was about the accumulation of wealth. And that motivation, you know, allowed for stolen land from indigenous folks, slavery, exploitation of low-wage workers. And so that's sort of the first time I think of, you know, the wealth being stolen, because a lot of the wealth in this country was originally extracted from or taken from indigenous folks and people of color. And then secondly, I think of the money, because the money is not going into the tax system and it's being sheltered and warehoused for charitable purposes, although we're not seeing, you know, again, only the 5% is actually making it out the door. That's another way that I think of the money as being stolen. And so there is a lot of entitlement I feel from the public to those resources that, you know, I think they need to be freed and liberated and actually invested in the community.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're going to grant the tax exemption at the federal or state level, you can attach rules to how the 5% was a rule passed in 1969. So you can attach strings to the tax exemption and see diversity. I mean, it's technically is possible. It's not that these private foundations are off limits. Talk about the idea as of money as medicine. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So I think of money actually being something that's neutral. We're often in our upbringings and our society, we think of money as a negative thing. And you know, I'm not anti-money or anti-wealth, which, you know, this conversation may give that you know, point of view. I think that wealth and money is actually a neutral thing. It is the motivation and how wealth has been accumulated to benefit only a few that I think is problematic. So in indigenous culture, we have an idea of something being medicine, and anything can be medicine that is an object or a place that restores balance and facilitates healing or restoration in our bodies and our souls. And so I think money actually can be medicine. And I say that because if we can put use money differently to actually be a tool that, you know, does not cause trauma, does not separate or divide or exploit folks, but actually is a tool that helps to facilitate healing, relationships, connectivity, and actually repairing some of the harm that has been done, then money can be used as medicine.
What does that process, that healing process, look like?
You know, in the book, I outlined 7 steps to healing that I developed from my own personal experience of coming to terms with some of my own identity challenges of being a Native American in this space. But also I borrowed from various places of indigenous wisdom, really, and one that is well known as sort of the restorative justice model. And so I applied those concepts, the process of healing, to institutions that move and control wealth. And what it looks like is going through a process of truth and reconciliation. In short, when we acknowledge where this wealth actually came from and the communities that have been marginalized from benefiting from the wealth that actually had a role in supporting the accumulation of wealth. When we think about who gets to manage, allocate, and spend the money and what that representation looks like, then those are sort of the deep questions of coming down, you know, boiling down to the truth of what's really going on in philanthropy. And then we can begin a process of actually shifting our mindset around money and resources to actually help repair and invest in a healing process.
Which includes listening more deeply to the communities that you purport to help, right?
Exactly. You know, after 14 years of doing this work, the number one thing that I hear from nonprofit partners and folks, investees of foundations, is that they wish that funders would simply listen to them. And, you know, that's not a big request. I think, you know, I think listening to another person is really almost like a human right. If we actually could sit in a relationship with a partner and community and really not talk, not feel like we have to lead, but take a back seat for a moment, put ourselves in their shoes and really try to open our hearts and minds to their experience and to their ideas for the future that they want for their community, we will be much better off as a sector, and we'll be much better funders. But that is a challenge for a lot of us working in philanthropy.
You make an observation about the indigenous way of giving and have a thought on the phrase Indian giver and how that plays a role. Briefly, how does that play a role, and what can we learn from the indigenous way of giving? Very briefly.
Sure. So Indian giver is a term that has come to be a negative thing. But actually, in indigenous communities, we think of giving in a very reciprocal way. And so we give to you because we know that in my time of need, you're going to give back to me. And so it's not a charity transactional model where I'm sprinkling money, you know, in places where I have no relationship. But it is actually being in community and knowing folks that I give to, so that in my time of need, that will be, you know, reciprocated to me.
Edgar Villanueva is the author of Decolonizing Wealth: Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. Edgar, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
You can find links to the work and more that Edgar does at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a bluegrass book takes an intimate look at the characters who have shaped that genre, and we'll talk about it on The State of Things after this.